Our first speaker is Declan Kutch. It's a policy director for the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and he took part leading to COP15 in Copenhagen in 2009, and he's doing currently a PhD on carbon markets and in environmental studies at the University of New South Wales. Declan, welcome.
Thanks very much, Juan. Struggling to find a way to contribute something to this when I was here yesterday. So I'm kind of caught between these two roles, which is my kind of hat as a campaigner and my academic hat as a PhD student. So I'm going to be kind of switching roles probably halfway through this. My talk is entitled "How Campaigning at the UN Climate Talks is Like Being a Kid at a Museum," and just to quickly summarise what the organisation that I have been representing, which is called the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, is about. We're kind of an umbrella organisation for the youth climate movement. Our mission statement is that we're building a generation-wide movement to solve the climate crisis. And essentially what that means for us is taking coordinated global action that could mean the difference between something like 2 or 3 degrees hotter and something like the Eocene, which is catastrophic climate change. So this is kind of the end game that unites our concerns, essentially. Just to recap some of the buzzwords that I picked up on over the past couple of days, museum paradigm needs to shift from communicating knowledge to hosting problem solving. So that's definitely something that I want to speak to today is how we can look at this process of problem solving by incorporating different actors and different concerns. Which is essentially what our organisation has tried to do. There are these other keywords here: soft power, trying to be impartial, this problem of fight or flight, communication exchange, value chain, balance, usefulness, relevance, tangible evidence, social contract, clumsy solution. So my contribution to this kind of field of language and framing is to actually take framing back a step to essentially to Irving Goffman's use of the term, which is how individuals make sense of use frames to make sense of their everyday world, and show how people are always kind of reflexive agents in this process, and how the youth were actually very much reflexively engaging with the kinds of frames about innocence and about their position in climate politics when we were campaigning in Copenhagen. And I want to open up this discussion of culture and agency as well. It was very much the central focus of yesterday's papers from the UWS guys and girls. Bringing in the role of the economy in showing how these issues of deliberation are solved, essentially, or kind of come to rest. Because I think one of the dangers is having kind of conceiving of science as this process, or trying to idealize some space where scientists are just talking and forget about the way that the economy solves or brings closure to these issues. But I'm also wary of this idea of moving away from science as something that is special and calling it just socially constructed. My favourite science studies scholar is Isabel Stengers, and she talks about the way scientists and science is powerful because it is a way of putting propositions at risk, and this is something that Karl Popper and philosophers of science have long been drawn to, is the way science is powerful because it brings the world out through its articulations. And there's always a political aspect of this, which David knows too well. And so that's the other thing I want to speak to. Play in museum. The motif that I want to have as the starting point of this was my visit to the Bauhaus Museum with my nephew. This was taken just after his first encounter with a real life helicopter, which is one of the most notable things that you encounter when you first step into the Bauhaus Museum. When I was babysitting him when he was in the second half of his second year of life, we'd often just watch helicopter videos to kind of calm him. And so to actually see a real life helicopter, his eyes practically popped out of his head, and he was just so tremendously excited about this. So the reason I want to dwell on this motif is the kind of drawing attention to the dangers of imposing my own narratives about adult life onto different encounters and different kinds of modes of identifying with objects and with things. In her excellent book, The Importance of Being Innocent, my colleague at UNSW, Joe Faulkner, talks about contests the role that innocence plays in modern life, and really contests this idea that innocence is about protecting children, and that it's really about protecting some aspect of us from politics and from work and from modern institutions. From the beginning of modernity, the task of delimiting the spaces in which children play has been motivated by commercial interests in the name of protecting them from adulthood, she writes. Modern notions of leisure time developing from new modes of production that afford certain classes luxury and leisure time are all implicated in this. So I was very mindful of the way my adult sensibilities about the Bauhaus Museum being a public space that needs to be policed as an adult space with certain dangers were kind of imposed in this encounter. All the while my little nephew was running around saying copter and pointing, and just was so tremendously excited about this process. So there's that sense of affective engagement that I want to draw upon here, but also its flip side, which is concern, in a very specific sense that I want to elaborate. So the case study I want to use here is my experience as the policy director of the Climate Coalition, working at the Copenhagen talks at the end of 2009. The graph that Professor Hume showed with the media interest in climate change spiking around 2009 is very, very instructive to the kind of tremendous emotion that was evoked during the lead up to this, and the tremendous attention that this process received. So my organisation, the Youth Climate Coalition, was part of some 25,000 accredited NGO people that participated in this event. There were 30,000 media from memory. I was trying to find exact numbers, but I think there's so much kind of trauma that's associated with the event that a lot of the websites, I think, have disappeared now. there was around 13 days of negotiations and a whole lot of other events and side events and parties and things that were associated with this event that was in a lot of ways kind of this carnival, essentially, where people were trying to come up with ways of engaging with this separation between, you know, how we're going to protect ourselves from ourselves. just to riff off a couple of Scott's points from yesterday, I was really struck by his the source of some of his or the affinity between these motifs in these modernist amazing modernist exhibitions and some of the motifs that we used in Copenhagen. This top photograph is a picture from the Internationals in Barcelona during 2009, showing the exact number of seconds until these talks were going to commence. So there's this sense of using clocks as this device to coordinate global concerns. And they had this enormous globe there as well. One of the kind of just to pick up this notion of framing and the way we the kind of disjuncture between youth or the problem of situating youth campaigning in this space is when we arrived, it was, you know, we kind of arrived as this carnival tent was just being set up. So it was all a very calm kind of space, and by about the third or fourth day there was queues stretching out for 7 or 8 hours to just get the accreditation, and it was an absolute madness. This was actually the culmination of about 2 years of planning for our organisation. We first attended the Bali talks in 2007 and started planning for our Copenhagen trip in the middle of 2009 and had all of our accommodation booked about 4 months out, and actually ended up hosting a couple of journalists and I had a very busy Fairfax journalist in my room for the talks, so there was actually a bit of a disjuncture between I think a lot of people's conceptions about youth organising and the way this actually played out compared to the kind of slapdash carnival-esque way that a lot of people kind of jumped onto it. It's just to kind of give you a visualization of just throw out a couple of images of the way this framing actually played out during the meetings. We were very conscious of our role as youth who had a very specific message to contribute to the talks, which was this is our future at stake. It's this amazingly circumscribed space, the UN talks, that we kind of have these roles that we're very explicitly told to take on. Ivo de Boer would actually say, you guys need to be more prominent, you need to come and make yourselves more visible. So it was actually a process of kind of finding ways to negotiate this and use it strategically that we ended up doing. So I just want to quickly run over some of the ways that we did that. Just to speak to this concern with actor network theory that some people had, or this link to actor network theory that had been made yesterday, this was a pretty good summary of the way this process of negotiating the frames during the conference played out. This is a quote from the sociologist Kieran Healy about ethnomethodology, which is one of the key kind of theoretical components of actor network theory. As a methodological innovation, it was more like the discovery of some subatomic states and quantum mechanical phenomena way out there in the world of big celestial bodies. Things look orderly and stable, and there was some plausible prospect of discovering walls of society. Even a little further down the scale, you could see where the structure was, and even if it was a little bit messier. Studies in ethnomethodology, however, zoomed in even closer on the micro level and found that it wasn't a level at all. That everything was constantly on the verge of going completely to hell, and that chaos loomed at every turn. even today when I read the bridging experiments, it's still striking just how quickly things move from ordinary, boring interaction to a bunch of confused, upset, and very, very angry people who don't know what is happening. So there's a sense that campaigners are always trying to kind of push the boundaries in this space. So this is just one example of this, us engaging with Christopher Monckton, the climate change denier. I don't mind giving him that label in this context. This is just an outline of the space of the actual talks. It was basically like this enormous city. Just want to quickly run over this idea that science is arranged around material devices. I think it's just a fundamental precept. I realize I'm running short of time, but I just want to quickly run through the way that it's important to show how how science and society are come to rest in formations that need to be contested in a very careful way by making sure that people who are involved in the innovation process have a chance to get their voices heard. So the way I conceive of carbon markets and the role of science in carbon markets. In carbon markets is this process of framing overflows and reframing by taking account of people's concerns. Just to kind of unpack this idea and the role of campaigning in this, and to speak to some of these concerns about citizenship that were raised yesterday, one of the notable things that happened in the climate change talks was people bringing concerns about their livelihoods into the actual talks themselves. So we had garbage pickers actually coming into a meeting of the executive board of the Clean Development Mechanism, which is the UN carbon talks, the main UN carbon institution. Carbon market institution, and saying we are concerned about our livelihoods because waste gas projects are taking our livelihood away from us because they're basically just burning the garbage instead of allowing us to take the valuable things out of it. I just want to wrap it up there. Just by saying. That we basically the most powerful thing we were able to do in these talks was basically provide make new connections with these concerned groups that had kind of emerged out of this process of framing and reframing the issues that have developed around climate change communication. That's all very brief and a bit messy, but I was just hoping to kind of respond to some of these diverse concerns. And thanks very much for your time.